Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Book Podcast. I'm Deidre Tyler, host. Today, we'll be talking with Regina M. Matheson and William W. Parsons, authors of The Pink Wave, Women Running for Office After Trump. How are you both doing today?
We're doing great.
Doing great. Thank you.
Thank you. I wonder if you could start by saying a few words about yourselves and how you got started on this project.
Sure. I'll start. I'm Regina Matheson, and I am a professor in sociology and criminal justice at St. Ambrose University in Davenport, Iowa, also serving as an associate vice president overseeing research and sponsoring programs and grants and things like that. And I've been at the institution for about 24 years. I'll let Bill go, and then we'll talk about how we got started on this project.
Yeah, I'm Bill Parsons, professor emeritus of political science at St. Ambrose University. I just retired this year after 35 years of teaching political science at St. Ambrose University.
So we've been colleagues for 24 years since I have been there. So we, which is what led us down the path of getting started on this project, we initially became interested in women in politics after the 2016 election. And we became interested in this topic largely because we just happened to be glancing one day at Emily's List, or heard something about Emily's List. And Emily's List is an organization that assists women who want to run for office. And it's associated more with the Democrat-leaning group. And there are Republican-leaning groups that are similar to Emily's List. But one of the things that sparked our interest was in 2016, after the election of Donald Trump, there had only been 920 inquiries of women interested in running for office during that 2016 election cycle. After the election in 2016, Emily's List received about 36,000 inquiries for women who are interested in running for office. So as good social scientists, we don't make assumptions about why that might be the case. More so, that really piqued our interest, and to move forward with answering the question, why is this the case? So that was our initial research question and how we got started on this project.
Okay, in chapter one, you talk about 1992 and 2016, and those were two periods that really pushed women into office. Tell us about that.
I'll start with that, and Bill can follow up. Certainly in 1992, it was recognized as the first year of the woman. That was when, if anybody recalls, Bill Clinton was elected president in that year. And some of the similarities we see with President Trump, especially with regard to women, were resurfacing. So after the 2016 election, that was also referred to as the second year of the woman when it came to electoral politics.
Yeah, and from a standpoint of the number of women running, those two time periods are slightly significant in that you saw an increase in the number of women running after 92. And then the number of women running, while it would increase slightly after that, the next real noticeable increase occurred in after 2016, as we pointed out, the tremendous increase in the number of women who were interested in running, and then a significant increase in the number of women who actually did decide to run. And we focused on the state legislature because for many individuals running for office, in terms of looking at moving beyond just local level politics, the state legislature is the starting point. And it's an area in which we thought was somewhat underutilized in terms of being studied comprehensively in terms of women running for office. And certainly we saw that increase there as well, a large increase in the number of women who decided to run for office in the state legislative office, often skipping local government and just going ahead and running for office, not having run before.
Now, there were some events that pushed women into running for office, the state legislature, the Me Too movement, Supreme Court justice, and the Roe v. Wade. Tell us about that.
Certainly, after 2016, you know, we saw the Me Too movement and women taking an interest in ways that they had not in previous election cycles. After 2020, we wouldn't have seen the Roe v. Wade, you know, the overturning of the Dobbs decision until after 2020. So we saw another slight spike in 2022 with regard to women running for the state legislature. So there's incremental increases since the 2018 midterm election.
Yeah, one of the difficulties in terms of seeing the impact of the Dodd decision is that by the time that Dodd decision was handed down in 2022, the primary season had already pretty much concluded. And so there weren't opportunities for, say, women at that point to really jump in response to that. Although when we looked at our surveys that came in for the women who were running in 2020 and 22, there was definitely an increase in the number of women who were seeing the Dodd case as an important part of the campaigns, not only for Democrats, but also for women running as Republicans.
Yes.
Now, you talk about the Trump effect in your book. Can you define that to the audience and tell us more about it?
Yeah, so in the book, we define the Trump effect as the influence of an insurgency candidate, namely Donald Trump, who elevated voter distrust in government to the point of creating a chaotic environment for all candidates from both political parties, essentially overtaking the Republican Party in 2016. And it's a definition that emerged from looking at a number of pieces of research, journalistic articles, that were in, you know, media, but also in terms of academics were looking at trying to figure out just exactly what the impact of the Trump presidency, the Trump campaign and the presidency was all about. But after having that basic definition, we felt it was important to talk about that a little more in depth. And so for us, the Trump effect is not simply about the personal or direct political impact of Donald Trump. The term is applied as a descriptor of U.S. politics since the emergence of Trump on the national political stage circa 2015. So when we look at the Trump effect, we're really talking about a condition in American politics that's broader than Donald Trump. And one of the things that he was really good at in terms of running for office, and really, I think, in terms of how he spoke and as president, was really tapping into social issues and conditions that were already out in society, but from a perspective of a group of voters, particularly conservative voters, thought was being overlooked. And not considered, and too much emphasis on, say, liberal side politics. So the Trump effect is really an acceleration of what was going on in society. And one final concept that I would comment on is the use of the term insurgency politics in the definition. That also isn't intended to really look at the presidency of Donald Trump as either positive or negative, but describing what was going on within the Republican Party in terms of turning it into a new focus that had been there but not formally emphasized before. And so if we think about insurgency politics historically, a good example of that would be Teddy Roosevelt, who turned the Republican Party as part of the progressive movement. And so many see Roosevelt as a great president. And then currently today on the Democratic side, you'd have Bernie Sanders, who would be considered an insurgent type of candidate on the Democratic Party, trying to move the Democratic Party further to the left than it has in the past. So in balance, when we're talking about the Trump effect, we're talking about a descriptor of the political times that we are living in today.
Thank you. Now, do you think women's social issues have been brought to the forefront as a result of women running for office, especially state legislators?
I think it depends on the issues. Certainly, you know, the cultural war issues don't just impact women, but they do impact a diverse population. With regard to reproductive rights, that's primarily going to impact women. It'll be interesting to see. This will be the first election, 2024, after that decision was made, the Dobbs decision, as Bill mentioned, in the summer of 2022, where we have seen women candidates at the state legislative level who have responded to our survey in 2022, both Republicans and Democrats, indicating that they did put their name on the ballot as a result of the Dobbs decision. But there were also some, you know, culture war issues that they indicated as well, which would be, you know, more broadly associated with diverse groups.
Now, what are some of the barriers that you talk about in your book that discourage women from running?
Okay. We had to talk about this in the book, mostly because when we finally came to the decision to couch our data and the findings in the context of the Trump effect, we had to discuss the 40-year literature that's been out there on women running for office and why they have historically decided not to run, basically. So we're seeing women in 2018 and 2020, especially interested in running because of what was happening at the national level. So some of those barriers that we have historically seen in the literature are political ambition. So they might have ambition to be in politics, but that gets outweighed by having a profession or a career that has traditionally led to being in politics, such as that of law or business. So in our data, in every year that we've collected data, we have seen a number of women who are not just in those traditional professions that lead to electoral politics. We have seen women who are in healthcare as well as in education on an increase. And we probably would see that trend at the congressional level as well with regard to women. The next one that also goes back to political ambition are the skills and women evaluating their skill set that they would need to have in order to run for office. And this is probably no different than other occupations or professions that have been dominated by males, is evaluating or over-evaluating one's skill set and looking at that skill set in relationship to their opponents, in this case in particular, but maybe not valuing the skill set in the way that we might value that skill set in a profession like electoral politics. And the last one, which should not come as a real big surprise, is family and caregiving responsibilities. You know, as you weigh those with not only political ambition, skill set, and having the background to be in politics, having to take care of one's children as well as one's aging family members, if that's the case, are going to factor in with regard to that decision to run. And what we found is that overwhelmingly, women, especially Democrats, were overlooking all of these things, skipping that first step to electoral politics, and that being at the local level, and jumping right into state level politics. We saw a lot of women running for the first time. Interestingly, the responses we've gotten to our 2020 survey, which are not included in our book because we're just now starting to analyze those.
2022.
Yeah, 2022 data. The 2022 data is that we're seeing a lot of women running for the first time, both Democrats and Republicans.
Now, you did some in-depth interviews. What were some of the things that you found from interviewing that the data didn't tell you?
Well, that's a good question. Well, one of the things that we did not offer that opportunity in 2018. I'm not sure why we didn't. We came up with the idea in 2020. So in the survey, when we sent it out, we asked at the end of the survey if they would be willing to participate in an in-depth interview. And overwhelmingly, out of the 221 responses we got in 2020, 208 of the respondents indicated that they would be willing to conduct an in-depth interview. So we had to sit down and really think about where were the gaps in the survey feedback that we had gotten, and really where were the gaps in the literature that we could contribute, you know, with regard to this book. So we ended up conducting 23 in-depth interviews. And of course, in 2021, in January of 2021, those were all virtual, which was great. We all learned how to use Zoom. So that was fantastic. But we first started with a group of rebound candidates. So those candidates that ran in 2018 and lost and decided to run again in 2020. And we chose that group largely because there's not a lot of literature on that group in general with regard to women, because it's a more masculine phenomenon in the electoral political world for men to lose and then run again. So we don't even see that in the congressional level for women. So we decided to fill the gap in the literature with regard to that group. And 14 of the ones that we interviewed were the rebound candidates. From there, after we interviewed them, we decided, okay, what are some other groups that we can focus on? And because of the growing interest in political geography, or that urban-rural divide, we decided to focus our interest on candidates who ran in the suburbs. And we can talk a little bit more about that divide a little bit later, but suburban candidates. And then we also, after that, decided to focus on some first-time candidates. And many of them, you know, indicated some of the same things with regard to their campaign experience, whether or not they would be willing to run again. One of those that many of them mentioned was, you know, when they knocked on doors, people would ask them flat out whether or not they were for or against Trump, regardless of what party, you know, they were representing. But even with the Republican candidates, they were seeing that as something that emerged. And just analyzing our 2022 data in the last couple of weeks, we're also seeing that same theme. So that national level political infiltration into state and local level politics.
Now, did the women see themselves as less likely to run in terms of qualifications?
I think we would talk about this in terms of a combination of things. And one of the reasons why we included a chapter on the urban-rural divide is largely because of the intersection with regard to all of these characteristics, or, you know, factors that were impacting their decision to run. And that was just one of them. So if they evaluated their skill set favorably enough to put their name on the ballot, they were also at the same time evaluating themselves with regard to having had a professional career that would lend itself to electoral politics, as well as the family and caregiving responsibilities, but also whether or not they were a good fit for their district. So that kept coming up as a major theme. So we decided to focus an entire chapter on the topic of political geography and campaigning and what their experiences have been and things like that.
Now, you did focus on candidates of color. What did you see with the candidates of color, women of color, and the party support?
Oh, we want to talk about that because we can't talk about that either without talking about political geography. So one of the things we have concluded is about, you know, how many more seats can women occupy? And this includes women of color. So I'll let Bill answer the question.
You know, what we know about the urban-rural divide, and this is for anyone running for office, not just women, but the urban areas are heavily supported for Democrats, rural areas heavily Republican, and the suburbs become the battleground areas in terms of trying to figure out those are the most competitive seats. And so, you know, the urban areas are where the diverse populations in the United States where they live. And so it's there where you're going to see the interest in and running for office. The difficulty is that where we're at right now with our politics is that with each of these geographic areas, there's only so many seats available. And so if you look at these urban areas, if there's an incumbent, if there's been redistricting done to make sure that that is a Democratic seat, it's very difficult for a newcomer to come in, whether it be male or female. But if the goal is to increase, and this is one of the mainstays of literature on women running for office that dates back to the 70s, is that one of the reasons that this is looked at is the goal of trying to get to more women to run for office and win an office. In fact, in the state of Iowa has this 50-50 by 2020. Yeah, 50-50 by 2020 program with a goal to get there, and but they're in like 30% range or something like that at this point. But like if you think about in terms of urban areas, if you really want to increase the diversity representation, there's only so many seats available. People are going to run where they live. And similarly in the rural areas, it's a heavily Republican area. Many of the seats there have an incumbent that's been there for a very, very long time. And so in both urban areas and rural areas, it's the primaries that become the important thing because you're basically deciding whether or not to run against an incumbent, because whoever wins that primary is quite likely to win the November election by large margins, including in many instances running unopposed. So one of the things that we've found with this is that while we're making incremental progress for women to run for office, and they will win at our same rate as men once they're on the ballot, but the opportunities to find places to run, we argue is very limited by where they live. They have to be comfortable in their district. There has to be a seat available in that district. And those things are just as important as looking at, say, any barriers that may be out there.
Thank you. Well, we know it's very complex. Running for state legislature in Chapter 4, what are some of the complex web factors that play a role in people running? Because it's very complex.
Yeah, I'll start with this one is looking at training opportunities. So as Regina was saying earlier, when you think about some of the traditional barriers that have been cited in terms of looking at in research about women running for office is becoming comfortable with the skill sets that you have and translating that into actually feeling that running for office is something that you can do. And so one of the things that we did try to look at in the research was what training opportunities are out there for women who want to run for office that will help them in terms of, you know, such things as fundraising, developing a message and that sort of thing. And a lot of that relates to party support. And that does become a little more complex. So for instance, the Democratic Party has for quite some time provided training opportunities and generally supportive of women running for office. But they too, at the bottom line is that you want to win elections, and so you look at what seats are available. As with male candidates, female candidates that are in a competitive race are more likely to get party support and funding support than if they're running for a seat where the other party has had dominance and looks to continue to dominate. But clearly the training opportunities are something that our respondents talked about and thought was important in terms of them and helping with their decision to run and to run the campaign. And did you want to talk maybe about the stereotypes a little bit, or messaging, or of the candidates?
Go ahead.
Okay. With the messaging, one of the things that we found for the Democratic respondents, they talked about the frustration that they thought they had very complex messages that were very difficult to them to really resonate with voters. Many of them commented that they thought that the Republicans had an advantage because their message was very simple and straightforward. And then with the stereotypes and some of the quotes, I'm not going to be able to think of some offhand, but the many situations where the candidates would be out there campaigning and they would not just amongst women, but women and that they were constituents that they were speaking with would make comments to them that they were convinced that those things wouldn't have been asked of a man, that they were being asked because they were a female. And so those things all entered into it. I think one of the most important things to come out of this was a sense that it's a complex thing to run a campaign. Women understood this, but many of them thought that they had a double burden because not only did they have to understand how to run the complexities of a modern campaign, they had to do that at the same time in terms of addressing some of these stereotypes that consistently remain out there about women running for office.
Yeah, just offhand, there were a lot of comments that these respondents made about when voters would ask them, you know, whether or not they had children, how they were going to balance their family with running for office. And many of the respondents mentioned to us that these likely would not have been asked of a male candidate. So, you know, even though we're in 2018, 2020, 2022, now 2024, I'm sure that those will continue to be asked of candidates who are male.
Well, how does the party determine who they will support? What goes into that in terms of male, female? What did you find?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that a little bit. I mean, the bottom line for the political parties is they're going to put their support, whether it's with say a campaign manager, volunteers, funding that might be available, into the seats that they think are going to be the most competitive and the ones that they most need to win in order to get control of the state legislature. And so that's true for male and female candidates. So the slight difference, I mean, the Democratic Party side, having identified those seats, they do provide opportunities for training opportunities that in order to try to encourage and groom female candidates more so than the Republican Party does. And the Republican Party, I mean, they're not, it's not that they aren't accepting or welcoming to female candidates, but there it's far more about the ideology and having the right ideology. So some of the conservative groups that are out there that would fund Republican females do so on the basis of the policy positions that they have. And so there's also money that goes to male candidates running as Republicans that support the female perspective. And so it's a little different in terms of how they look at it. The Republican Party is far more about promoting the ideology than they are in terms of looking at increasing the numbers. And again, whether it's right or wrong, the Democratic Party has had a genuine effort in terms of saying we want more women, we want to reach that goal of equity amongst men and women running for office. So, I mean, neither party is resistant to it. They just have a slightly different way of looking at it. The Democratic Party has been more proactive in terms of increasing the numbers.
Yeah, one of the things I would like to add as well to that is the positive impact with regard to the notion of the Trump effect, not only on women running, but women evaluating their district. And it, especially with regard to rebound candidates for those who ran in 2018, lost and ran again in 2020, all of them mentioned, at least in our research, that they had gained seats. They had made strides with regard to either moving that seat in a different direction or potentially making that seat flippable, therefore gaining more support of their party. Most of the time it was the Democratic Party. So those are, you know, all of the factors that when we think about running, it's just, there's a lot of intersection between many different variables.
And that's one of the things we really tried to emphasize in our book, because I mean, we scoured the literature of women running for office, which dates back to the 70s. And one of the things that we thought was really missing was to try to understand the political climate that women were running in and how that political climate intersects with the historical factors that relate to gender in politics, or the stereotypes about running. And so we feel that for women interested in running for office, reading this book can give them a kind of a realistic look at, here's the barriers, here's the political climate, a deeper understanding and thinking about what's involved for running for office.
Absolutely. Now, in your
one of the, Deidre, before you move on, one of the things I wanted to mention earlier about the training opportunities, you know, through these organizations that provide that information to women is the sense of camaraderie with regard to what these women experienced or may experience on the campaign trail. You know, having people around you, not only who are similar to you, but who are also experiencing like things is really important to one's confidence and feeling like, you know, they're making the right decision to run. So those training opportunities provided a lot more than just, you know, how do you run an effective campaign?
Absolutely.
So, go ahead. I interrupted your question.
Thank you. Now, you talked about the restrictive campaigning laws. How did this make things difficult for women?
Well, I think, I mean, the restrictive laws that would exist would obviously be there for male candidates as well. I think in our case, it's really more about looking at the district, the politics of the area, and whether or not that person is comfortable in terms of running in a particular area. And maybe, you know, not that it wouldn't be a factor, but the whole notion of the training aspect, becoming comfortable with running and learning about the campaign laws and that sort of thing would be part of it. That would be true for both male and female candidates. But I think what we're really trying to get at is that the key for women is to think about that intersection between the political climate, which would include any restrictive laws, and looking at how they're going to navigate with the realities of, you know, running for office and some of the things that women face running for office within those within the context of laws that might exist.
Yeah, another response that might address your question, Deidre, is A lot of the women that responded to our survey and that we spoke with mentioned specifically how managing their campaign funds and how those campaign funds could shift to supporting more women running for office, especially with regard to family caregiving responsibilities, so childcare and things like that. So if those could be included in those campaign finance laws rather than be restricted, that would potentially open up more opportunity for women to run for office.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because if you think about the fundraising and related to campaign finance laws, the existing laws, do they all relate to how are you spending your money related to the campaign, such as on events, advertising, and that sort of thing? So Regina makes a really good point. The one thing that is missing is that in most areas, there would be laws on the book that would not allow you to use campaign funding for caregiving.
Yeah.
And you'd need, and if you're going to campaign equally out there, you'd want to be out there and campaigning on that same level as a male candidate who may not have to worry about the caregiving side of campaigning. That's a really good point.
Now, what is the overall message you'd like the reader to leave with once they finish your book?
Well, I think I hit it at it a little bit. I think the message is that we have this sort of long history of literature related to the barriers of women running for office, but that by adding the political climate, the culture that we have right now today, whether it be coined as the Trump effect or the urban-rural divide, women interested in running for office can read this book and see that this is something that they can do, win or lose, and that they can navigate this world just as good as any other candidate. And then towards the, you know, at the very end of the book, we have a number of quotes where we ask, you know, women about the future. And it was really rewarding to see that whether they won or lost, the vast, vast number of women who participated in our survey saw it as beneficial, something they were glad that they would do. And even if they didn't run, they would continue with community involvement in some capacity, encourage other women to run. So despite looking at, say, this political climate and thinking that the book may be about the negative side of politics, I think we hope that people would read this and see that there are some hopeful things to come out of this, that the opportunities can be there and women are able to compete just as well as a male candidate in the political climate that we have. And many of them come away feeling much better about the experience rather than if you're looking at the news today, it's, you know, people looking at it as a very negative thing.
Yeah, the majority of our respondents indicated that their experience was very positive, and they wanted to relate that to other potential candidates. But we mentioned in both the first chapter as well as the last chapter that when we wrote this, we really wanted to appeal to both an academic audience as well as a lay audience. So for people who might have an interest in the current political context that people are running in or that people are voting in for that matter, they could pick up the book and find it of interest to them. As well, people running for office, not just, you know, women, even though, you know, we were most interested in women, many people who are similar to these women running, especially with regard to political geography, might experience the same thing as many of these women running described as their experience. So we wanted to write this for the lay audience as well as that academic audience, but especially the lay audience, again, both from a voter perspective and from anyone who's considering running for office might find an interest in it.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. Can you tell us the next projects you guys will be working on?
Sure. We are going to be elaborating on this political geography and focusing on the rural urban divide. And we are in the midst of that right now. And hopefully we'll have something in the next 12 to 18 months. There's a lot on this, and certainly the upcoming election will help to solidify this project for us, and the next few election cycles for that matter.
So we mentioned that we put out a survey in 2022 to women running for the state legislature, and we're organizing that and looking at it this point and seeing to what we might want to do to continue this with 2024.
Right. We probably won't send another national survey. You know, as we've talked about this, we don't think we'll find anything different from that quantitative perspective. What we're finding in our 2022 data that's really not really surprising, but a number of women commenting about the politically hostile environment, getting threats for their, you know, campaign messaging and things like that. So we'll probably move forward with more in-depth interviews, more qualitative work on this topic, and just focus on, you know, the political and urban rural divide, political geography, urban rural divide.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that new research. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Have a great day.